Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America, recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Tuesday at 5. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Every week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in NYC. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live from the new WBAI studios, or for myself, from my apartment. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 56,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 5,500-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. The COVID-19 pandemic is a humanitarian crisis on a global scale, but not every government has an equal ability to respond. In Iran, the effects of U.S. sanctions are devastating the population's ability to adequately protect itself from the coronavirus. Observers estimate that every 10 minutes, an Iranian is dying. This is a man-made disaster for which the U.S. war machine bears the blame. Today, we're talking to members of NYC DSA's anti-war working group about their campaign to end sanctions on Iran. What is the human cost of U.S. sanctions on Iran? And why is it so important for the socialist movement to invest in organizing against the imperialist war machine? But first, the headlines from Simone Norman.
In local news, new data shows that Black and Hispanic New Yorkers have died disproportionately of COVID-19. Garbage pickups in Manhattan and Queens are revealing the divergent ways different neighborhoods have been impacted by the coronavirus crisis. The New York Times explored the slow and ineffective response to coronavirus from Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio. The paper also looked at the neighborhoods in Queens that have been hardest hit by COVID-19, including Jackson Heights, Corona, Elmhurst, and East Elmhurst. After Mayor de Blasio announced that New York City schools would be shifting to remote learning for the remainder of the school year, Governor Cuomo appeared to overrule him, calling the mayor's announcement an opinion, although the mayor does have authority to close city schools. A surge in the number of New Yorkers dying at home suggests that the city had been undercounting COVID-19 fatalities. The city is now counting those deaths in its reporting on the disease. Governor Andrew Cuomo announced that New York will send an additional $600 per week to unemployed New Yorkers. Amid concerns that the MTA is not protecting its workers from the virus, the agency has reported a 20-fold increase in confirmed cases. Although the New York State Senate was sent home indefinitely after it passed the budget last week, multiple senators are floating plans to address the crisis facing renters throughout the state. Senator Brian Kavanaugh of Lower Manhattan introduced a plan for rental vouchers, while Senator Michael Giannaris of Astoria wants to waive rent for affected tenants for the duration of the emergency. It is unclear if or when the Senate will be able to vote on any such proposal. Nursing homes around the city are suffering from major shortages of staff and supplies, resulting in the rushed hiring and training of new nurses. Subway ridership is down 92% due to coronavirus, with many essential workers still relying on public transit, voicing concerns for their safety. Mayor Bill de Blasio is proposing major cuts in the New York City budget, including eliminating the Summer Youth Employment Program, canceling the expansion of the city's free 3K program, and cuts to Vision Zero, a program to streets and sidewalks streets and sidewalks safer for pedestrians and bikers. In election news, since Senator Bernie Sanders has suspended his presidential campaign, New York may cancel its presidential primary. And New York State will allow all voters to vote via absentee ballot in the June 23rd primary. Voters will still need to apply for an absentee ballot.
Our daily headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So we are joined today by Amy and Dylan of the NYC DSA Anti-War Working Group. Amy and Dylan, can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
So Dylan, Dylan, I can hear you. Amy, are you there, or we're still waiting on you to join us?
Yes, can you hear me? I'm here.
Yes, I can hear you. So thank you so much for joining us in these trying times. And before we dive into our specific topic about the relationship between the sanctions imposed on Iran that are devastating the country amidst COVID-19, we like to introduce our guest to our listeners and kind of just have you share your experiences in organizing. So what forces propelled you both into the socialist movement? Like, why did you join DSA specifically, and what sort of organizing are you involved in? Amy, if you just want to go first.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having us on the show. Super excited to be here speaking about all this. And my history starts actually with organizing many years ago, probably close to 20 years ago in Austin, Texas, as a member of the ISO, or the International Socialist Organization, back then during the Bush years. And a lot of organizing was happening around anti-globalization and anti-capitalist movements. So I was really involved in a lot of that organizing because, for obvious reasons, capitalism was crushing us, is crushing us, and I was really kind of activated by all of the activists that were going out for the WTO, for the FTAA, for all of these massive mobilizations. And so from there, I moved to New York, and sort of my orientation shifted a bit from direct action organizing to, I'm an artist and an educator, and I started making more politically oriented artwork and kind of pursue, and a filmmaker, and I was pursuing political sort of subversion in those realms. And then over time, I'm Iranian American, and you know, there's always been xenophobia against Iranians, but after and leading up to the, you know, during Obama and then leading up to Trump, you know, the Muslim ban, Trump being elected, everything that was happening then really galvanized me back into an organizing mode. And so I started doing more direct action organizing around that time. And currently I'm involved in the South Brooklyn DSA branch. I was just elected to the organizing committee of that branch, which is very exciting for this year. I'm doing a lot of organizing around electoral politics and how we can kind of get our democratic socialist ideals into electoral politics a la Bernie or AOC, but to sustain that power, collective power. And I'm also doing a lot of work around currently tenant organizing, you know, leading towards potential rent striking for folks that can't afford to pay rent anymore, as well as doing a lot of mutual aid work in my neighborhood of Sunset Park, but also citywide through the DSA and through organizations like Mutual Aid NYC. So, you know, it's a really crazy time, and also exciting time to be activated to organize. So I was saying this to Dylan, and this is like very back of my mind, but because of all of this organizing I've been doing around electoral politics, and I've been kind of involved in some different campaigns over the years, I'm considering potentially running for city council in my district, which is District 38 of Brooklyn, to kind of get our ideals into the system to keep sustaining the power and the movement that kind of have been started and paved by many and continued by Bernie. And I hope, you know, to potentially continue them into the future as well, to learn and to share the resources around how do you run for office and sort of demystify it so any of us can do so. So that's sort of back of my mind.
Well, if that potential run comes to fruition, we would definitely love to cover it here on Revolutions Per Minute. And it's very clear that you've been involved in the struggle for socialism for a long time. So, Dylan, what about you? Like, what? How long have you been organizing? And like, what sort of struggles have you been engaged in? And what compelled you to get involved in the socialist movement?
Sure. I definitely have a shorter history of involvement than Amy, but I think the thing that compelled me, I don't know, I feel like the inciting incident for my involvement in anti-war work was watching the Iraq War unfold while in high school. Specifically, I remember watching Chelsea Manning's leaked video, Collateral Murder, in my high school computer lab, as it was kind of like something I had never seen before. For those who don't know, that's the video where you see U.S. soldiers shooting a group of journalists. You can hear them talking about it in the video, kind of joking about it. And it was a pretty horrible, eye-opening thing to watch. I don't know. I was still in high school, and I don't think I really got politically activated for a while after that. I grew up in Concord, Massachusetts, and was very into my homeboy Thoreau, and that was kind of the framework of my politics. I had civil disobedience, but kind of a more like individual withdrawal from the war economy and capitalism and all these immoral systemic injustices, until Trump got elected, which I think is probably a familiar story for a lot of people. Like, as soon as that happened, that kind of individual politics didn't seem sufficient anymore. And then I actually got involved in the DSA through this anti-war working group. That was the first meeting I went to, found it on Facebook, open to the public, figured why not. And it was the first space I had been in that was really just very encouraging about what we could do, and like, and teaching me, a newcomer, that like I had political power. So I was interested in the war in Yemen at the time. I had been reading a lot about it, and the people in this working group were basically like, great, here's what you can do. Here are the first steps you want to take if you want to start a campaign around that. Here's these trainings we'll provide to you. And from there, I joined the DSA because I wanted to vote in our meetings. That's pretty much... and now I'm on the organizing committee of the anti-war working group. And that's kind of been the focus of my work in DSA for the last couple years.
And that's exactly what we'll be exploring more the rest of this episode. And you hit on a couple of key, like, formative moments in your radicalization. And the first one you discussed was the Iraq War. And I think that is a shared experience of many people in the younger generation. It very much helped shatter the myth of American exceptionalism with the reality of brutal imperialism. And while the war itself is, and the horrors that it unleashed on the Iraqi people is well known, what is often less discussed in the narrative is the sanctions that the United States imposed on Iraq during the 90s, as well as a bombing campaign. And it is estimated that these sanctions led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians in Iraq. And now we are in a similar situation where the United States has imposed sanctions on Iran, a country that a certain faction of the ruling class, at least, has been attempting to invade and destroy for decades. So What are sanctions? And are they actually a peaceful alternative to war? And like, what are the distinction between sanctions imposed on apartheid South Africa and a U.S. sanctions that are imposed on a country like Iran?
Sure. It's a great question. Yeah, it's a good point about the Iraq war sanctions. I feel like we kind of learned I don't know if we fully learned the lesson, but our cultural memory agrees that a full-scale invasion like that, that was either a mistake or a disaster, but we haven't learned the same lesson about sanctions. And I think the lesson that we should have learned is, like you said, sanctions kill people. They're an act of war. They're very different from, I think, the conventional view of sanctions that Americans have, which is, kind of based on the model of sanctions in apartheid South Africa, that they're this nonviolent kind of intervention. They're a kind of soft power that the U.S. can invoke to respond to human rights abuses and humanitarian crises and to kind of coerce governments into abiding by international law. That's a very optimistic view of sanctions. And in some ways, it is true about how they worked in South Africa. There was, a concerted call from civil society at the time for sanctions to end apartheid. And today, we have a similar call from Palestinian civil society in the form of BDS, which the DSA endorsed at a national convention, I think, 2 years ago, and which we've also been pushing for in the anti-war working group. But there is a big difference between these kinds of sanctions and the kinds of unilateral sanctions that the U.S. Uses and has leveled against Iran and Venezuela, North Korea, which, yes, are incredibly destructive to the countries and the people that live in them. I think one important distinction is that these are unilateral sanctions as opposed to the multilateral sanctions in the case of South Africa. You had, people. That campaign went around to a number of different countries and companies to petition them to divest and boycott South Africa and impose this these sanctions on the country. Versus in the case of Iran sanctions, the U.S. has unilaterally declared these sanctions, in fact, against what the rest of the world agreed to in the Iran nuclear deal. And the U.S. uses its military and economic power and its massive role in the world trade and financial institutions to basically bully and frighten other countries and companies into compliance with its sanctions. This means that these sanctions are usually not based in human rights or international law, and they don't come out of the international community. They explicitly or specifically advance U.S. interests in the region. And I think it's no coincidence that in the case of both Iran and Venezuela, they are some of the largest oil producers in the world and generally not very compliant with the way the U.S. wants to run its oil trade. So I think that's one way to look at it. I think you can also just look at the effects that these sanctions have, and the intended effects, which is sometimes a hard thing to suss out. But you can clearly see that, like, these sanctions the U.S. has imposed don't lead to better human rights in these countries or more equality. They in fact have the opposite effect. They have the worst effects on civilians and the poor and working classes of these countries, on women and children and more vulnerable minorities. There are a few studies that cite these sanctions as increasing inequality within these countries, sometimes giving more power to the governments that the U.S. claims it wants to sanction, which is effectively the opposite. It's the opposite effect of what we call for in the case of BDS, and which is for ending apartheid and holding a country accountable to international law. I think that's a good overhead, and we can get a little more into the details around that concerning Iran.
Yeah, that, I mean, I think that was an excellent summary, and something that you were hitting on, and is a really crucial distinction to make, is that sanctions against countries like apartheid South Africa and Israel are specifically related to settler colonialists and their descendants who are imposing rule upon the indigenous population, and that these regimes, whether it was the former South African apartheid regime or the current Israeli government, are also basically states that operate as part of the U.S. empire. They are client states of the United States, and it was pressure from below that pushed the U.S. government to impose those sort of restrictions on South Africa. It was actually that regime was dependent upon the United States in the same way that Israel is. While in Iran, and that doesn't mean we don't have to have criticisms of the regime, this is not the similar situation. This is a government that emerged in reaction to imperialism. So I just want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we are talking about the relationship between American imperialism and the devastation that is being inflicted on Iran by coronavirus. We're just discussing sanctions as like a broad strategy and tactic of either empire or, in particular, unique situations against empire. But we're going to continue to explore specifically what sanctions are doing in Iran. So in what ways are the current sanctions imposed by the U.S. empire on Iran killing people? What are the distinctions between the death toll from the virus in Iran compared to other countries? And why is this phenomenon not being reported on by the corporate media?
Yeah, I think these are really important questions, and thank you for asking them. So just to like give a broad overview, and Dylan spoke about this so well, but the way that sanctions are working within Iran, the U.S. has placed restrictions on Iran's banking system, manufacturing industries, and what countries can do business with them. So imports to Iran are really limited, and Iranian businesses can't afford to purchase imports. In the case of COVID, these are medical supplies and humanitarian aid, so, and medicine, and the ingredients to make medicine, as well as protective gear for not only civilians, but doctors and other healthcare workers who are trying to treat the virus. There's been an argument, you know, that you'll see in the media that, well, but, you know, there's a Swiss humanitarian aid channel. Other countries like South Korea are trying to give humanitarian aid, and that Trump hasn't hindered humanitarian aid from happening. The problem with those arguments is that because Iran's economy is so crushed by sanctions right now, you know, they're $200 billion in revenue, primarily from decimated oil sales, is what Iran is dealing with now in terms of not having that at their disposal. The currency is devalued by over half. So that being the case, Iranian businesses and the medical industry can't afford to purchase what's being offered to them in humanitarian aid. And not only that, but the countries that are potentially trying to do business and help Iran out at this time are really afraid of engaging with Iran for fear that their countries will then be sanctioned by the U.S. as well. So this is a huge issue, and what it translates to is that there's an uneven and a huge lack of, as I mentioned, medical supplies, protective personal equipment, testing kits, etc. So what's happening is we're seeing a humanitarian crisis of the scale of 3.5 million Iranians projected to die by May, and what they're saying already is that an Iranian is dying every 10 minutes. So where we're at now is that, you know, these sanctions are forcing the Iranian government to do things that it hasn't done in, you know, 60 years, which is try to get a $5 billion loan from the IMF, which the U.S. has shot down, and which is also problematic. I mean, and we could get into that. I mean, there's like, that's another story. The whole show about the IMF and the problems of the IMF to begin with is not necessarily a good thing, right? But they're in such dire need of help, financial help right now, that this is what they're kind of trying. And even that is being blocked by the U.S. And the problem there is the U.S. is the IMF's largest shareholder, which largely determines the fate of bailout requests. So technically, you know, other IMF members could bond together and try and rebuff that. Everyone's so afraid that it most likely won't happen. So what we're seeing is at every turn, Iran being blocked from basic humanitarian aid for people in the country. And as Dylan mentioned, it's problematic because these sanctions are not, you know, what they're trying to affect, the change that they want to see happen in Iran at the governmental level, you know, stopping nuclear production or, you know, oil exports, et cetera. The real people that are being affected are people like you and me, moms, dads, people who can't afford to get these resources, access to healthcare, access even. And the other problem is, I mean, sanctions have crippled the economy so much because of reducing imports and exports that even basic supplies like food, milk, meat, stuff like that, the prices of all of these, all of this is skyrocketed inside the country. So we're seeing this humanitarian crisis not only, you know, in terms of this moment of COVID, but generally just in terms of, you know, quality of life really, really adversely affecting, you know, folks like you and me, people just on the ground living in Iran.
I think you hit on a number of crucial points about what makes this so barbaric, the way that it is devastating working class people in Iran, making their situation even worse than it normally is for working people who have to struggle every single day to survive. And then in terms of the IMF, it's always so important to recognize that the IMF and the International Monetary Fund, for people who are not familiar with the acronym, is not a neutral institution. It is a institution of the American ruling class of capital and empire to discipline anyone who they view as a threat to the capital accumulation of the American ruling class, anyone who defies the geopolitical order that the American ruling class dominates, or at least is attempting to constantly dominate. And then lastly, the intended goal of these sanctions, it's really, really crucial that we always point out that this has nothing to do with spreading democracy. The U.S.'s number one ally in the region, in their campaign against Iran, is Saudi Arabia, which is one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world. And we can never forget that. And we can never let the propagandists in the U.S. state or the corporate media escape that reality, that this is a campaign that is about the U.S. finding a way to seize control of the raw materials in the region and to kind of stomp out any challenge to American hegemony. And the corporate media is doing whatever it can almost always to prop that up, as opposed to a station like ours, WBAI, which is actually committed to reporting on the reality of what is happening in the world and the people who are suffering under these brutal conditions. So let's turn now to the organizing that is being done by NYC DSA and anti-imperialists here in the United States who are trying to stop this from happening, or for maybe even for people who can be pulled in by the organizing that is happening. So, like, what is currently being done to stop this barbarism? What campaigns is the NYC anti-war working group involved in? And, like, who, maybe some DSA members, in fact, are taking a lead in our government?
Yeah, that is a really great question. And I realized after you had summarized that, I had forgotten to mention the corporate media. I think that's a really important point. Super quickly, I had some statistics about that the New York Times ran 439 stories that mentioned Iran and the coronavirus since February, and 9% referred to the sanctions. Same with the Washington Post, 85% of the stories about Iran did not mention sanctions. And with the Wall Street Journal, only 19% of the stories on Iran since February have mentioned sanctions. So that's a really critical point, that people here are not aware that this is even happening, because the U.S. is kind of, you know, has this blood on their hands. And so, you know, one thing that folks can do, and what we did in the anti-war working group, was really try to blast this information out and make it known. And we have some representatives in Senate and Congress that have really helped as well. Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and tears, Bernie Sanders. yes, though he is still in the struggle. Everyone remember that. He's still center. The three of them penned a letter that in recent days that we really tried to push out, and we got 34 representatives to sign on to this letter that basically said that sanctions against Iran at this time are causing a humanitarian crisis, and that we need to lift them for the time being during the crisis of COVID to save everyone's life, basically, to save the lives of civilians, people like us in that country. And so that was an amazing campaign that I was so lucky to be a part of. Our whole working group did so much work, and it was also a coalition-led effort. And what happened with it is that they sent the letter. Of course, who knows what that's going to mean. What we really pushed people to do within the DSA and then nationwide was to call their reps, email their reps. We had petitions circulating around this issue to really raise awareness around it. And so that was like the last push that we did. The other thing that's currently happening is that Ilhan Omar released a series of legislation she's trying to get passed, a package called Pathway to Peace. And it's an amazing piece of legislation. And so I would recommend that folks look it over and read about it. It's progressive, equitable, and constructive engagement is what peace stands for. So it's a package of 7 bills aimed at reorienting U.S. foreign policy to rethink America's approach to foreign policy by centering human rights, justice, and peace. And so one of those is the ability for Congress to have oversight over what sanctions are in place in what countries, and to actually vote on them and not have them be decided unilaterally in executive orders. And also, because of the way that sanctions work, they're supposedly under the International Emergency Economy Powers Act, IEEPA, and the key word there is emergency. And so, you know, what has been declared an emergency in a lot of countries that have sanctions imposed on them is something that's been going on for many, many years, decades sometimes even. And so part of her legislation is to limit the amount of time that a quote-unquote emergency can be called. Because, and okay, can I just say this? This is a fact that not a lot of people know, but with the whole issue of Iranian sanctions in particular, you know, trying to stop their nuclear program, I don't know if folks know this, but the nuclear program in Iran was developed in the 1950s by the United States. So yeah, let's just let that be known.
it normally turns out to be that way.
Right?
Yeah.
So
it's
yeah,
almost like our foreign policy is constantly inconsistent, trying to respond to problems created by us in the past. Things never turn out the way expected, and no one suffers any consequences for it.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, Dylan, do you want to speak a little bit more in terms of, because so AOC and Bernie and Ilhan Omar, you know, issued this incredible letter, but then there were other lawmakers that kind of responded to that letter. Do you want to talk about that a little bit, Dylan?
Sure thing, yeah. Yeah, thanks, Amy. That letter, just to clarify, it's a letter to the Office of, it's OFAC, and I'm forgetting the acronym, Office of Foreign Asset Control. It's part of the U.S. Treasury, petitioning them for to give sanctions relief to Iran during coronavirus, like temporary sanctions relief. And we were supporting it, like Amy said, through a social media campaign, you know, emailing reps. Coronavirus has disrupted a lot of our ability to organize in the streets in more conventional ways. But this got some traction. It got 30 representatives signed on, including Bernie Sanders, Ilhan Omar, Elizabeth Warren, Barbara Lee, I believe, signed on. But it also got a pushback from some other members of the party. Specifically, Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey, who is the ranking member of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, and Representative Elliot Engel of New York 16th District, who is the chairman of the House Committee on Foreign Relations. So two of the big dog foreign affairs Democrats in the New York and New Jersey area responded to this, issuing a statement that basically said, whoa, whoa, slow down. We don't need to lift sanctions despite the coronavirus emergency. Here's what we should do instead. And I just want to read a part of it because the language is pretty amazing, I think. Menendez's statement starts, "The United States has imposed sanctions on Iran for its nefarious nuclear weapons development, support for terrorism, and human rights abuses. There is no evidence that the regime has stopped its sanctionable behavior. Moreover, simply lifting sanctions that have been imposed for ongoing malign behavior will not provide immediate or meaningful relief for the Iranian people." So just to clarify there, it's always worth reminding people about this when it comes up. Menendez mentioned the nefarious nuclear weapons development. Iran does not have a nuclear weapons program. Iran has a nuclear civilian energy program, which is the subject of the sanctions and the Obama-era nuclear deal. It was to monitor that nuclear energy program and prevent it from, you know, people are afraid if you have a nuclear energy program, you can enrich uranium to the point that it could be used in nuclear weapons. But there is no active nuclear weapons program in Iran, at least from any credible sources that we know about. So it's a fun little lie he has right there. But it's also worth remembering that, I don't know, it's not surprising. Menendez and Engel both opposed the Obama's nuclear deal with Iran. Engel, who claims now to be the leading member of the House opposing military engagement with Iran. He's become a champion for these war powers resolutions recently, which is certainly not a bad thing, but it's a little absurd to, on one hand, oppose military engagement with Iran, and on the other hand, defend these sanctions, which are destabilizing the country, killing people, and heightening tensions with Iran. I want to run through real quick some of the things that Menendez and Engel say we should do as a kind of contrast to what we're advocating for. They say that the administration, the Trump administration, should publicly clarify that U.S. law does not penalize medical or humanitarian transactions meant to fight COVID-19 pandemic, and publicly promote ways that financial institutions and governments around the world can help fight the pandemic in Iran. So this is nothing. This is just reiterating what everyone, including financial institutions, already know, which is that U.S. sanctions do not technically block humanitarian aid to Iran. There are loopholes for it. But this is completely insufficient. The aid, even though it's not blocked, is still conditioned. Under General License E, individual donors can't give more than $500,000 per year to Iran for humanitarian purposes. This is something these representatives think should be changed, but they mention it. It's the case. Even if you say that aid isn't blocked, it's capped. And beyond that, there are certain kinds of medical equipment that require special approval. Chief among those are oxygen generators, which, you know, are pretty important right now to fight coronavirus. So it's a bunch of, you know, weasel words to paper over the fact that the Treasury has made this process of contributing aid so complex that no banks or institutions or other countries even want to take the risk of running afoul of one of these complicated rules. And the administration is constantly talking out of two sides of its mouth on this. You know, we have Pompeo saying the same thing and at the same time being a member of United Against Nuclear Iran, which is a private NGO that goes around lobbying countries and companies to not do any kind of business with Iran. Just basically scaring them out of even what might be legitimate transactions. So that's worth knowing about because that's very local. I think the question of how we respond to this, how we respond to our representatives failing us in this way, and our representatives who we did call and email, who issued no statement or response to those calls and emails, that's still an open question. You know, if we weren't under lockdown, we might be sitting in their offices using tactics that have been effective in the past for our Yemen campaign and so on, directly targeting these representatives. But we're in a different time right now. We're very online, and we're trying to adapt our organizing accordingly.
Yeah, the struggle to adapt organizing to these new conditions is something that I think is on the mind of almost all socialists who are actively engaged in the struggle, and something that is outside of the legislative pressure that I found extremely exciting and is kind of part of this broader wave of labor action that's taking place. And while it wasn't directly related to the sanctions against Iran, I think it showed the possibility of a kind of anti-imperialist labor movement, was that the workers at General Electric in Massachusetts, who normally are producing machines for war, demanded that instead they should actually produce medical equipment to deal with the crisis at hand. They were, in a certain sense, demanding to seize the means of production and control what was being produced for human need rather than for profit and for the War Machine. And I just also want to remind our listeners that you are tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Connect with us after the show. You can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can also find us on our website at revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com or on Twitter at NYCRPM. Today, we've been talking about the sanctions in Iran and how a coronavirus has made the situation even more barbaric. We have a few minutes left in the show, so we'd love to hear from the listeners. You can call in at 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. And while we're waiting for some listeners to call in, I was just wondering if either of you had thoughts on kind of what I was mentioning before about this kind of building power and struggle against empire outside of the legislative sphere. And also, how can our listeners get involved with the fights that you've been describing?
Yeah, I think these are really important questions. And I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of saying that we're all kind of in this pivot moment together trying to figure out how to tap into organizing efforts right now. So one way that, so there's a couple of different projects that we're working on currently in the anti-war working group. One is a video project that maybe we could send the script and a link to y'all to post on the site so that people could be part of this project. It's basically sort of after Bernie and while we're still seeing these humanitarian crises rage on with Iran, we're trying to like motivate organizational energy by making a video that says why people join DSA and why they're still fighting and why the struggle. And so though it might seem like, okay, you know, what good does this do? As Dylan mentioned and as we're seeing right now, in quarantine, the most impact in a lot of ways that we can have besides, you know, making calls and writing emails, which are so important to our legislators, is engaging with social media and doing the reporting that is not being done by the corporate media. And so to get a younger generation who's tapped into Instagram, who's tapped into Twitch, who's tapped into all of these different online platforms, to get folks, TikTok, et cetera, to get folks excited about staying motivated and staying organized. And I know some of the things that I mentioned, you might be like, those aren't the greatest platforms. And I think for me, and this is me speaking for myself, thinking broadly in terms of the reach that we have and utilizing platforms to get the message out on a large scale is really critical to keep energy around these campaigns and these issues moving. So contributing to this video project, saying why you joined DSA, why you're excited about like continuing to organize, I think is important. We also have a media project that we're working on with Hoda Kotebi around what are sanctions to get people sort of informed about this issue outside of the scope of just this moment. We also, in organizing under the new landscape, I mean, this is a huge question, and I think we're still sort of retooling, and we would love as many people as are interested in these issues to join the anti-war working group and to work in coalition with all of the different organizations we're working with, because as Dylan mentioned at the beginning of the show, it's a very inclusive group that's very open to ideas and open to new ways of coming together in this environment. And because we're sort of figuring out what the next sort of like powerful pressures that we can put on the lawmakers is, I think this is in a really exciting moment for organizers to start jumping in on some of these campaigns and really getting active.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't want to cut you off because I think you're hitting on some really important points. But we do have a caller. Caller, you are live on Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI. We have to get off the air in a couple minutes, so please keep your comment brief. What is your name and what's your question and or comment?
Hi, my name is Max Irwin. I am a socialist. I'm a member of DSA, but I'm also not very active right now. I have two things to say. I'll try to be as quick as I can. My problem right now is, well, I'm a cab driver, and I haven't been able to work for a month, and I cannot keep doing what they tell me to get unemployment and food stamps, but I can't finish the applications. I think it would be nice if somebody could find a way to make a website or something that we can, something besides labor.newyork.gov, which obviously I've done a thousand times and never finished my application. Meanwhile, I'm going through all my money. Okay, if anybody does that, they can tell me about it. I don't know how to make a website. That would be maxwirwin@gmail.com if you want to tell me about that. What was the other thing? I don't know what the other thing is. I didn't hear the whole show. Okay.
Thank you so much, Max, for calling in. And I believe people are working on helping people out with that process. So hopefully they're tuning into the show and can help you out. If we would love to bring someone like that on air. Amy and Dylan, I just we got to close off in a couple in like a minute or so. So any last comments for our listeners? I just want to thank you both so much for coming on.
Sure. Thank you so much for having us again, Jack. This has been great. I guess I want to shout out real quick to the caller. There's an effort NYC DSA is involved in and called Mutual Aid NYC. You can go to mutualaid.nyc, and there's opportunities to volunteer and contribute, but also to request help if you need it. I'm not actually very involved in that, but I understand that's an effort and it's maybe somewhere to look if you're struggling with the coronavirus conditions in New York. And otherwise,
well, I don't want to cut you off, and thank you so much for sharing that information. It's really crucial to get to mutualaid.nyc if you need some help. I just want to thank you both again so much for coming on Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI. We will keep our listeners updated with your campaign and all things that the anti-war working group is doing. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back at 5 p.m. on Tuesday next week.
Thank you so much. This is amazing. Thanks for holding space for this.
Thank you for coming on. Yes.